I'm not one that likes to get up in front of people. I can talk anyone's ear off in one-to-one or a small crowd. But this was important to share with you. Some of this is going to be my life story that I have woven into this. And some of it's really painful to share. So if I get emotional, please just bear with me. All of us have a story. However we got here today, we have a story. Today I'm going to share you with part of mine. I work on a daily basis counseling with individuals trapped in darkness, and I've walked in it personally myself. I work at the Great Falls Pre-Release with men and women who have committed a felony, and some lots of felonies. Many of them have sad stories with sad beginnings. Many have been born into families of crime, drugs, abuse, and that's their normal life. Some of their stories are so heartbreaking that it makes it understandable for the choices they have made. Sometimes I do assessments and I just weep after, because hearing their story is so painful and what they've gone through. There's times when I've gone home and just cried and cried and cried. And my husband goes, "What's the matter?" I said, "Because there's so much pain." And we hear that pain, you know, we do in our jobs, and it's really difficult at times. But it's important to be there with them. I've often referred to them as the walking wounded. Many have experienced such pain we can't even go there. Some of them come from good families, though. Some of them had good upbringings. They just made choices that weren't always so good. We deal with a lot of people that are angry and they're hostile. Underneath the anger, if we can reach them, is pain and fear. They have fear of fitting in what we perceive as normal everyday life. They have fear of being accepted by others. They think, if only you knew the things I did, you wouldn't like me. And they try to hide. And they have fear of what life will be like without the drugs and the alcohol to numb their pain. I'll tell you about one of my first clients. I was just a new counselor, and I had my office, and I'm all happy with that, you know, had all this stuff. And I get my first client, and he walks in, and he is 300 pounds, and he's 6'3". And the reason I know that is he informed me. So here's this giant, and he wasn't a gentle giant. And he sat down, and he goes, "Let me tell you something." And I said, "Okay." He said, "I don't like women. I don't like whites." He was Native American. And he says, "And I've killed people." This is my first guy. My knee was shaking so bad. And all I could think of is, I can't let him have control. So couldn't see behind my desk. I had to put both hands on my knee to, you know, keep it from shaking. And I said, "Okay, that's all fine, but we need to talk about your drugs and alcohol." And he looked at me like, "What?" You know, I was scared. So I went into my boss's office after, and I said, "Why don't you like me?" And he said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Look who you gave me, my first guy." And he says, "Because I know you could handle him." I'm like, "I don't think so. I don't think so." Anyway, he was very intimidating. He'd get in groups and intimidate the group, and people would say, "Karen, deal with him. Tell him this and this." And somehow I was able to do that. There was a time when he went on what we call a rampage, and my boss got a phone call, and then he called me, and he said, "You might be in danger." I'm like, "What?" And he said, "He's put people in the hospital. He's after everyone that has been in his life recently." And I'm thinking, "That's me." And so I get this phone call, and I pick it up, and it's him. And I'm like, "I'm dead. He's going to kill me. He's on his way." And he said, "Karen, I've done some bad things. There's a couple people in the hospital, and I'm on the run." He said, "But I want to tell you, I might not have done everything you would have asked." He said, "But I will one day." And I thought, okay, I'm going to live. That was the big thing. And you know, this man calls me once a year. It's been 25 years. He calls me once a year to tell me how his life's going. You know, so this man I was so intimidated by had turned out to turn his life around. In staffing, we'd get people. And I don't know if I ever missed being in staffing or I got the short straw, but I'd get the toughest people, the most angry. No one wanted to deal with them. And so I got this guy that was so angry, no one would say what his diagnosis was because they were afraid he'd hurt them. So it's like, "It's up to you, Karen, to tell him." I'm like, "Great." You know, when they're angry, if you can see, it's just pushing people away because they have fear and they have pain in their lives. So he's barking about something about the laws and all this. And I said, "Look, I'm your last hope. Nobody wants to work with you. It's up to me to work with you, and I don't really want to right now either. So you need to leave, think about it, and then call me when you want to do something. So he did call, and he came back in, and later the secretaries go, what did you do with him? He's actually nice. He comes in, and he's pleasant. You know what? Because I hung in there with him. I stayed there with him. I try to get past all that. So it's really important when you have people that are angry and pushing, don't let them push you away. Just try to stay with them the best you can. I'm not saying don't let them disrespect you, but I'm saying don't let them push you away because that's what they're trying to hide. Many of these people, they live in darkness, and they recognize they have to change if they want a different lifestyle. Mr. Wilson's book, Cleansing the Cup, is about changing on the inside so we can change on the outside. Outside changes are only temporary. We can look good, dress up, clean up, but unless you change the inside, what's in your heart, you're not going to keep that change. I have a plaque in my office that says, do not be afraid of change. Be afraid of not changing. There's a male inmate at the center that I work with currently, and he was a member of the Crips in Los Angeles. He was into gang violence, dealing drugs, selling women into prostitution. But when he went to jail, there were people that came and ministered to him. They brought the word of God. He said to me the other day, if God can change someone like me, he can change anyone who wants to change. Currently, he's in counseling. He attends church. He attends Bible studies. And he mentors to the young people there, bringing them the word of God. So people can change. Even when people would come in and they've had 13 treatments, some of the staff would go at the hospital when I worked up there. They'd say, what are we going to do with them? What can we teach them? And I said, I'll take them. And they said, great, you can have them. And I said, because you gave up hope. You guys have lost hope that people can change. I believe until they take their last breath, people can change. So I'd take them, and you know, sometimes it worked out, sometimes it didn't. But we can't give up hope on people because we may be the only string that they're holding on to that can help them. Let's see. My husband, he worked for an agency in town. He's a licensed addiction counselor also. And he was told in a staff meeting they could not bring up the word God. They weren't able to talk about God because they might offend someone. Fortunately for me, we can still talk about God. I have plaques and sayings in my office that represent my beliefs. When I do an intake, I always ask people what their spiritual belief is. It's important because I know what direction I can go with them. I have to watch boundaries because I don't want to ever be told at work that I can't talk about God. So if they have a belief, I have somewhere to go. If they're searching, I have somewhere to go with them. Some of the things they have told me is they believe in aliens, Satan. I've had satanic worshipers. And some just don't believe in anything, and some believe in the earth. Darkness in our lives takes many, many forms. For alcohol and drugs, they give the illusion of relief and comfort, but they never will. They're used in an attempt to fill a void, but the void gets bigger, and it requires more of the substance. Alcohol and drug addiction is about self, self-centered, self-pity, self-indulgent, self-sabotage, and just plain selfish. Addiction distorts the truth. You live in a lie. You lie to yourself and others. There's justification, excuses, blaming others, lack of taking responsibility, all of which addiction thrives on. Morals and values are lost. Family and loved ones suffer. For every addict and alcoholic, there's 10 people that are affected. I personally got caught up with alcohol and drugs. I came from a really good family, so it's nothing about my family that led me that way. I have 9 brothers and sisters, 6 brothers, 3 sisters, and I'm the 9th out of 10. But something always felt different about me. I felt like I didn't fit into the family for some reason. I had a void. I even went as far as to have my mom pull out my birth certificate. She goes, why would you think you're not, you know, from this family? I said, I just got to see it, Mom. I just feel different. Well, I was. They were my parents, and those were my siblings. But I got into drugs. I fell into a different path. meth was one of the drugs, and there's a book out called Meth Equals Sorcery. And I don't know if anyone's read this, but they used to give it to the women at the Montana Women's Prison. And this guy became a pastor, but he went through meth, and he talks about it being demonic. And he talks about how far and how deep it takes you. It's such a dangerous drug. People often become paranoid and have hallucinations which are demonic. It's destructive mentally, physically, and emotionally, and it's very powerful. From my experience, I was clean and sober for 10 years. Wasn't always praying, wasn't putting on my armor, got complacent in life, and I'm bebopping down the hall one day, and the secretaries go, "Karen will know." And I thought, "Karen will know what?" And this woman had a pipe. It was like a test tube with a hole cut in it. And I said, "Oh, yeah, I can tell what was in it." And I smelt it, and it was meth. And I said, "Oh, that's meth." Gave it to her, didn't think anything of it, walked up the hall. Halfway through, my brain lit up. And it was like, that was meth. Ah! And it scared me so bad. This is 10 years away from the drug. I went to another counselor's office, and I sat down and started crying. And I go, "What's the matter?" I said, I wasn't thinking. And I smelt this pipe. It was all in innocent. And it triggered my brain. I said, "It was the stupidest thing." They go, "Do you think?" I'm like, "Yeah, I do think." But that's how powerful addiction is. You could be so many years off from it and just not paying attention, not praying, not putting God first, bebopping through life, and it can hit you. For those of us that are alcoholics and addicts, one is too many and 1,000 will never be enough. In treatment, we use the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going to talk about these steps and see how they can help us spiritually as Christians. In AA, step one, we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol and drugs, that our lives had become unmanageable. As Christians, we can admit that we're powerless over, you fill in the blank, whatever it is for you, and our lives had become unmanageable. This is when we're engaged in self-will and have chaos and havoc in our lives. In AA, step two says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. As Christians, came to believe that only God can restore us to sanity and restore us spiritually. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over the care of God as we understood Him. As Christians, made a conscious decision to follow the Word of God and align our will with His. There's other steps till you get to the 12th step. And the 12th step is, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of working these steps, we tried to carry the message to others. As Christians, having aligned ourselves spiritually, we are willing to carry the Word of God to others. Another area of darkness I'm going to talk about is anger and resentments. They can trap us in darkness. Resentments pose a considerable problem for many, many people. If you examine any problem that comes between people, you'll probably find a resentment lurking in that area. The word resentment means to resense or refeel. Resentments are old anger that we have nurtured. Resentments have no positive side. It's simply a destructive emotion. And I'm going to give you an example of one of the clients I worked with. He came into treatment like 3 different times. His wife left him. She got a divorce because of his drinking. This is before stalking laws. But he'd park outside of her house with a bottle. She had remarried, and he'd drink and drink and drink. When he'd come into treatment, his liver's shutting down. He's getting all yellow. And I said, "She's moved on. You have to make some change." Eventually, when he was able to let go of his resentment for her moving on, and take responsibility, it was his drinking, his consequences, his behavior that led her to the point where she had to leave him. Once he accepted that, he was able to stop drinking and he was able to move on in his own life. Anger certainly has its place in the emotional makeup of healthy human beings. Anger can be honest and appropriate in certain situations. Anger is not the problem, it's how we respond when we are angry that is the problem. I am sure that we must certainly think, if we act in anger, are we demonstrating being a Christian? I don't know if you guys ever get honked at or flipped, you know, someone flips you the bird. It happens to me when I'm driving, and I don't really know what I did wrong. But the car will pull up beside me, and they may have a Christian symbol. They may have a bumper sticker that says something about God. And they're flipping me off. And they're honking. And I think they must have borrowed someone else's car for the day. Certainly a Christian wouldn't do that. An example of anger is there was this young son, and he would say the meanest things to his brothers, sisters, and parents. And finally the dad thought, how am I going to teach him about this? So they had a wooden fence in the backyard, and the dad said, every time you get angry, I want you to take this hammer and this nail and put a nail in the fence. So pretty soon the fence is filling up with all these nails, and the kid had apologized. And then one day the dad said, every time you apologize, pull the nail out of the fence. And the kid did. When it was all done, he said, take a look at that fence. What do you see? And the kid said, I see a bunch of holes in a damaged fence. He says, that's what anger does. When you continue to do it, even though you apologize, you've caused damage. You've caused hurt and pain. It doesn't all go away. So if you're doing lashing out and doing that, just remember, even though you feel sorry when you calm down, you've already created pain in someone. We're told by the administration at the pre-release center that we need to role model good behavior. And when we're out in public, we represent the center. So they always want us, because we're role models following the law, because we deal with felons and that, so we have to be good citizens. Wouldn't that be the same for us as Christians? When we're not in church and we're in the community or the workplace, what does our conduct demonstrate? In James chapter 1, verse 19, it says, understand this, my beloved brethren. Let every man be quick to hear, which means be a ready listener, slow to speak, which means a speaker of carefully chosen words, and slow to anger, being patient, reflective, and forgiving. The next thing I'm going to talk about, this was hard for me in this talk, let me tell you. It's about materialism and overabundance. And we kind of laughed about this after the lunch break, the shopping. Okay. The world we live in today is that of excess and material possessions. Materials can possess us. It is dangerous when we're looking for material things to make us happy. When we get caught up in needing the newest, the biggest, and the best. It can become so excessive, it becomes to the point of hoarding. Excesses and hoarding can entrap us. Clutter not only clutters up our homes and our lives, it clutters up our soul. Look around at the storage units in town. Try to rent one if you needed one. They're full. And why are they full? People have more stuff than they need that they'll never probably use, but they fill up storage and keep getting more. It was kind of not so funny, but I was telling my husband, I guess I could take a picture of my closet and drive the point home. He goes, yeah, that would be good. That would make a good point. I'm like, whatever. When I was growing up, we had two pairs of shoes. Well, we had 10 kids, so we had two pairs of shoes. We had school shoes and we had play shoes, and you better make them last. You didn't try, you know, you had to be really careful with those. So I made a decision when I got older. I'm going to own as many shoes as I want. I'm going to have any color that I want because I can. And I did. And I probably could fit everyone in here with a pair of shoes. So doing this talk, I have started cleaning my closet, to be honest. And I've donated shoes and things that are excess. It bothered me to do this because I thought I have to look at me really hard and the things I'm doing. And, you know, if I'm going to tell people to do things, I need to do them myself. And so this was kind of a hard lesson, and my husband just laughs because he thinks he's been telling me this all along. Obtaining material things can only make us temporarily feel good for the time being, but soon we experience shame and guilt. And I don't know if any of you have done that, but when you've bought something, you think you need it, you get home, you kind of feel bad about it because you really didn't need to spend the money on that. So what do we do? Well, I know I do. I go get more. Ease that guilt. This is called retail therapy. Still trying to fill the void, turns into compulsion. Being materialistic can fill our need and ego through accumulation of stuff. God knows we'll never be happy indulging in our material desires. It is Satan's trap to keep our focus on ourselves and what we have and our material desires and our focus off of God. When we do this, we're not trusting God to provide our needs when necessary. In Hebrews chapter 13, verse 5, make sure that your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have. For he himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I forsake you. In Matthew chapter 6, verses 19 through 21, do not store for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourself treasures in heaven, where neither moth or rust destroys, and thieves do not break in or steal. For where your treasure is, there is your heart also. Justifying our behavior to accumulate material items can be heard in the sayings, the devil made me do it. Well, he actually didn't make us do it, because we do have free will. But he could have helped influence us a little bit with that little voice. Yeah, you really need that. Yeah, that'll look good on you. Another justification can be that God is testing me. James chapter 1, 13 through 15. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. You see, if we choose earth and all that it offers us, it'll cost us heaven. If you choose heaven, it'll cost you earth, giving up all those material things. God gives us light, love, happiness, and salvation. Satan gives us darkness, confusion, distractions, and destruction and temptation. One of Satan's greatest tricks is trying to convince people that he's not real. People don't want to believe it. You know, they just choose not to and can do what they want. He's very real. In 1 Peter chapter 5, 8, be of sober spirit, be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking to devour. Satan tries to distract us, so we shut out God. How does he do this? It can be in subtle ways. For example, excessive hours at work, which keep us from family. Today, many people work well over 80 hours in the pay period, trying to keep up with the material things, working weekends, holidays, and when at home, the computer's humming. They're just too tired to interact with the family. It can be used as an avoidance of dealing with problems and family issues and emotions if they're just too darn busy all the time. Priorities are out of place. God is not first. So, a little story. My coworker, his name's JT, and so I'm up at the hospital doing my bebopping around, and he said, Karen, take this test. And I said, what is it? He said, just take this test. And I said, all right. So I went home, and I'm taking this test. It was about being a workaholic. So I read the first one. My husband goes, mm-hmm. Well, I had to check it. I think there were 10 questions, and I hit 10 out of 10. Well, I go back. I go, oh, I'm a workaholic. My gosh, because I transferred my addiction from alcohol and drugs to workaholism. And he said, do you think? We all knew that. My husband wasn't surprised. But it wasn't anything anyone could tell me. It was taking that test and looking at it that realized I was avoiding life. I was avoiding family. I was avoiding feelings. I was avoiding anything I can because I'm too busy at work. And I justified that. So we got to be careful in that area. Music. Music is another means of distraction. Some music's very dark and has troubling messages and language. How many people do you see with earbuds on, or you can hear the music blaring in their car when they pull up next to you? As parents, are you paying attention to the music your kids are listening to? Because it will have an influence on them. How can we enjoy the beauty and peacefulness of the world around us that are gifts from God if we're distracted? Another story. See, I keep telling on myself, but here's another story. I remember a time when I was living in Salt Lake, And I was always on the move, busy, busy, busy. And a friend gave me a ride home from work one day and commented on the rose bush that was outside my front door. I said, "What roses?" And he laughed and said, "Karen, slow down. Stop and smell the roses. Because see, in my busyness and haste, I miss seeing something so beautiful as my focus was elsewhere." Then we have video games that kids play for hours on end. A lot of parents allow this because it's a babysitter. Kids are busy. They can do whatever they want. A lot of times it's just watching their favorite TV programs. If your children play video games, watch what they play. Many are very violent and seductive in nature. In the 90s, I don't know if you guys remember this, but there was a popular game called Diablo. Diablo's Devil in Spanish. There's another game out called that's really popular now. It's called Grand Theft Auto. It has the player killing people to get cars or just killing them because they're in their way. And there's prostitution in the game and a lot of profanity. So if your kids play games, really watch what they're playing. Speaking on the subject of games, as an adolescent, my friends and I used to have seances when my parents weren't home on the weekend. We called those nights, Friday nights, as taco and seance time. One time, my friend's cross necklace came off her neck while we were conducting a seance and calling forth a spirit. All of us were holding hands at the time. She had red marks on the back of her neck, like scratches. Well, that scared us, so we stopped that game. Then we tried levitation, and that worked, and that scared us, so we stopped that game. Then came the board game called the Ouija board, which is still sold in toy stores, toy departments. Very dangerous. This definitely scared us because it actually moved around without pressuring or pushing. What seemed like innocent fun was getting into the occult and darkness. Then as an adult, same friends, we started enjoying going to palm readers, card readers, fortune tellers, and reading our horoscopes, which are all against the Bible. I can't say I really believed in them, but they sure were a form of entertainment and intriguing. I was telling a coworker about it. His name's Robert, and he told me it was against God. There was a passage in the Bible about this, and I said, you better show me because I don't believe it. So he showed me Leviticus chapter 19, 31. Do not defile yourselves by turning to mediums or to those who consult the spirits of the dead. I am the Lord your God. Well, I've not engaged in any of those since. Oh, but I've been tempted. 10th Avenue South, there's a sign, palm reading for $10. Then I remember what that Bible verse says and what God says, and I keep on driving. There are only two sources of spiritual power, God and Satan. Witchcraft and the dark practices are Satan's realm. Although we may desire to know the future and control events, they're not ours to control. Since the Garden of Eden, Satan's major focus has been to divert human hearts away from the worship of our true God. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 11. Put on the full armor of God so that you'll be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. For our struggle is not against the flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the full armor of God so that you'll be able to resist in the evil day and having done everything to stand firm. The next part, I'm going to talk about cell phones. Probably everyone in who doesn't have a cell phone in here, is there anybody? Okay. Yes? Oh, okay, one person. Okay. Cell phones are so popular today. They can be helpful and useful in many situations, but they also can affect the way people communicate. Many people text more than call. Although it can be convenient at times, it prevents an emotional connection. Bullying has become easier for kids when they don't have to face the person they're bullying. Look around you when you go to dinner and see couples sitting across from each other. They're on their cell phones. And worse yet, the whole family could be out to dinner and they're all on their cell phones. I've seen parents taking their kids to the parks and letting them play. And while they're glued to their phones, the whole time they're not enjoying watching their child at play, hearing the laughter, those things you don't get back. You don't get second chances on this. When you stay busy with all these other things, one day those kids are grown up, and guess what? They don't need you because you haven't built that relationship with them when they were kids. You were too busy, on the phone, whatever it was. So if you have kids, they're the most precious gift we can have. Then I'll talk about social media. Now, I know there's means the younger people use, but I'm going to talk about Facebook. There are good purposes for its use. However, I know people who troll around it to find out about what other people are doing so they can gossip, and they actually become obsessed with it. I know someone that just can't put down Facebook, always on it. And they said, well, do you want to, my daughters are older. They go, do you want to know what your daughters are doing? I said, nope. If they wanted me to know, they'd tell me because they're adults now. So I don't want to know that. Behavior in our society that would have previously been unacceptable has become acceptable. People are afraid to speak out in fear of offending someone. Well, we as Christians may have to offend people, a lot of people, to stick up for our beliefs. Relationships are another area I want to talk about. My sister would tell me that in a room full of people, I would attract the only alcoholic or addict in the room. Of course, I laughed. I didn't believe it. But later I was able to see the truth in her statement. You see, darkness attracts darkness. And when I was living in darkness, that's what I attracted. At one time in relationships, I thought that as long as someone said they believed in God, that was good enough. Although their behavior did not reflect that. I do not understand the saying, I didn't understand it then, that believing is just not enough. You have to have action. And when Sherry is talking about domestic violence, I was in a domestic abusive relationship. And what I want to say is, if you are, don't give up on that woman. Statistically, it takes 7 times for a woman to get out of it. And I was the statistic. 7 times. I've had a gun held on me. I've been choked. I've had marks on my neck. And when I went to help from his family, they said, we're going to have you go to a shelter because we're afraid of him. So when I was trying to get ready to leave, I was vacuuming the floor one day, and I heard on the TV, don't accept unacceptable behavior. And I sat down and cried because I thought, I'm a child of God, and I'm letting myself be treated like this. I had 2 small children at the time, so I was really afraid to leave. And what made me further scared is he said he'd hunt me down like a dog and kill me and the kids. But I thought, if I can have 30 days of freedom, it's worth it than living in this with him and the children. You know, today I'm still kind of fearful of him. I saw him in a crowd once, and I got separated from my family, and I ducked down in the crowd and hid because I still don't trust he wouldn't hurt me. It impacts you when you're in an abusive relationship. When you see women, I didn't ask, you know, like before I was in one, I thought, why would you let someone hit you? Why would you just not leave? But it's not that way. It's grooming. It's slowly mental. It's control. He loves me so much. He controls this. He's worried about me. You know, my family, he pushed my family away and made me think that they didn't love me. And I thought, if this man doesn't love me, who would love me? You just get psychologically ill in that. So please, if you know someone's abusive relationship, don't judge them. Just be there for them because they'll need you. And just your kindness and compassion can help them move to get out of that relationship. A lot of women don't make it out, which is unfortunate. James tells us in chapter 2:14, what use is it, my brethren, if someone says he has faith but has no works? Can that faith save him? You see, it's what's inside of a person and how they have a relationship with God. How they treat others, how their values and morals line up with yours, and how their lives reflect that of a Christian life, which is most important. If we are in a relationship and move in with someone, how can we expect God to bless the mess if we choose to go against the Bible? It's important to have friends that hold you accountable and share your Christian values. Friends influence us either in a positive or negative way that can affect us spiritually. Choose your friends carefully. My mom would say, birds of a feather flock together. They do, and it's true. I used to always think I could be the good one and shine a light on others. Not so much. Because a lot of times they pulled me into the darkness. Further speaking about relationships, I honestly did not understand what a relationship with God meant. This kind of gets hard for me. Hold on a sec. I grew up in a Catholic church. I was taught to fear God. We were taught that we carry the original sin at birth and we're never good enough. I went to Catholic school until the fifth grade. We had nuns for teachers, and some were abusive and would humiliate students. We were taught that unless you were Catholic, you would not go to heaven. And I remember feeling sorry for people that weren't Catholic, other kids that weren't Catholic, adults, because they weren't going to go to heaven. They weren't Catholic. I had gone to confession, and there was one time that I went to confession and I told my sins, and the priest said, "You can't be forgiven." That was devastating. The Catholic Church teaches that there are two types of sins, venial and mortal. Isn't sin a sin? Like Sherry said, there's no degree of sin. A sin's a sin. There were so many rules. I had a coworker who did tell me about the relationship with God, and it sounded so strange to hear that. I'm like, what? It's like God's his friend? By the way, it's the same one that told me about the verse in the Bible about the fortune tellers. I did not feel I had a personal relationship with God. We were not encouraged to read the Bible. When I mentioned to my priest that I wanted to participate in a Bible study, he told me to be very careful that I was not taught against what the Catholic Church teaches. My coworker warned me that I would go through a spiritual warfare when doing a Bible study. I had no clue what a spiritual warfare is. Was I to find out? I asked him, "What does it mean?" He said, "You'll see." I started Bible studying with Jay, and the first thing I said is, "I am Catholic, and I'm not going to change." Yeah, here I am today. Through learning what God says in the Bible, the beliefs I was taught in the Catholic Church clashed hard. I quit Bible study for 2 months. I stopped going to church. I prayed. I didn't know what path to follow because I'm being pulled into this path, but my whole life was this path, these beliefs. I felt so confused and I felt so lost at that time. I couldn't talk to my family because they're all strict Catholics. There's just no going around that. I really felt I didn't have anyone to talk to but God. I remember waking up in the middle of the night. I would bounce up in bed and my heart would be racing. And I'd have such panic and I couldn't breathe. And I'd just start crying because, you know what, deep down I knew I had to take a different path and was giving up what I had known all my life. It was so challenging. But then I remembered something I had told Jay, and that changed everything for me. I told him in the beginning I loved the church. Yes, I said I loved the church, not God. I then realized it was all about the church, the rituals, the rules, and the control I was bound to. It was not about having a personal relationship with God. I can now understand what it must feel like for someone to have to be reprogrammed, as everything I believed in was not true. I was misled by blind faith and doing what I was taught, and I was also taught not to question. As I have shared, I got caught up in the drugs, alcohol, unhealthy relationships, dabbling in the dark realm of what I thought was harmless games. I had been on a path of self-destruction. I did not like the answer no or being controlled. My favorite saying at the time was, "You can't control the uncontrollable, and if you try to control me, I'll just get more uncontrollable." Little did I realize I was being controlled and I was under the influence of Satan. I believe that the changes in my life today are due to people who showed me kindness, compassion, and demonstrated how Christians live that made me want to change. They would shine their light of love, hope, and faith. You see, when we think at times what we do does not make a difference, I'm here to say it really does. It did for me. My life wasn't always chaotic. There was one time when I was 19, and I joined the Brothers and Sister program. I was doing good at that time. And I had a little sister, and she was 10. And I'd pick her up, and I didn't have a lot of money to do a lot of things, but she always wanted to go to my house. I'm like, okay. Well, it was just kind of a crazy thing, and her mom never, she wasn't cleaned or groomed, so we'd play cleanup. We'd play doing the nails, washing hands, doing the hair, styling the hair, because I just wanted to show her some things that her mom probably wasn't doing. She eventually moved. Well, she'd eat dinner with my family and loved playing games and just being a part of that. She eventually moved, and we lost contact. We didn't have cell phones then, so we lost contact, and she was a kid. And then one day I'm at work, and this name comes across my desk. I've never heard the name before, and I've never heard the name after. And I thought, this has to be her. She was a contact for NA, Narcotics Anonymous. So I thought, I'm going to give this phone number a call. So I called. She wasn't home, but her husband was. And I said, this is Karen. I lived in Butte. I was her big sister. He goes, oh, my gosh. He said, we go by your house every time we're in Butte. She makes me drive by because it had a rounded kitchen. He goes, rounded brick kitchen? I go, yeah. He said, she tells me that was the best time of her life. When I got in contact with her, little did I know, at 10 years old, her dad had her smoking marijuana. She was being sexually abused, and it was just a traumatic lifestyle. And she said, I thank you. She said, I thank you for the time you gave me because you showed me how things could be. So she got into recovery, and now she's helping others. So it does matter what we do, even when we think it's not that important. There's a story about a starfish. One day, hundreds of the starfish washed up on the beach due to a tide. There was a man who was walking along, and he would bend down every few steps, pick up one of the starfish, and toss it in the ocean. Another man came along and said, what are you doing? How can throwing a starfish in that you pick up every now and then make a difference? The man quietly picked up a starfish, looked at it, then tossed it in the ocean, and he said, it does to that one. When I reflect on my life and the choices I made, I remind myself of the verse of the Bible that comes from Romans, chapter 8, verse 28. God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose. God calls us by name. Satan calls us by our sin. So we need to remember, Satan will remind us of the bad things we've done and keep us stuck or keep us caught in that. God loves us, and he calls us out by our name. We need to remember we are dead in our transgressions, and God makes us alive and emerging, and he shines on us. In ending, I want to encourage each and every one of you to see your light and love, to shine through the darkness to help others, like me, who were lost. Remember the song, This Little Light of Mine? I'm going to make it shine, let it shine. Well, I'm going to let my light shine, and I hope that you, my sisters in Christ, will keep your light shining. Some of you may remember the advertisement for Motel 6. At the end of the ad, Tom Baudette would say, we'll keep the light on for you. I will close this talk with the same statement, we'll keep the light on for you.